Welcome to the Abn Abn Podcast, a podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're sysadmin working on the help desk, you're a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer techie who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And this is episode 41. Now, do you remember when so Roger Bannister broke the four-minute mile running? You know that he wore the race number 41 on his jersey there?
I don't remember it.
Not physically.
Because it was in 1954.
No. But we'll come back to that in a minute, actually, because it's also the atomic number of niobium. It's the sum of the two squares, 4 and 5. And, of course, there was a band... I can't remember when they were around, some 41. And it's also the age that me and Jerry will be in exactly 1 year's time.
Yeah.
So, and this is episode 41 of the Abn Abn podcast. So it's been a few weeks since we were last on. So what's everyone been up to?
Well, it is Friday the 13th today, so hopefully everything will go okay. I've had quite a few problems at work today with like servers filling up with space and pausing virtual servers, and have a dead disk as well in the server. I've had to go and replace. So we had a phone call today about Hopper's free time. We've got this product which I've probably talked about before called RMN product, a remote management remote managing tool. We'll go into more about that in a minute at the end of the show, but it basically if a server goes offline, we get alerted about it, and it helped us through. We got like 10 alerts coming through from all our customers saying all their servers have gone offline. So they phone up in a panic going, no, our phones are working, nothing's working. And I was just hearing the guy talking on the phone. I was going, and it wasn't the internet. We got onto the router, but anything past the router, we couldn't get onto. But then occasionally we could get onto the servers, and then we couldn't get on off to the circuit. And I was saying to the woman, have you done anything? Have you done anything? No, we haven't done anything. And I'm like, do you know what it was? Can you think of what they could have done where all these servers have gone offline? And that basically, they didn't have any. They had no network connectivity and no internet access at all.
Sounds like something to do with the turning the switch off at the wall, or turning the router off at the wall, or something.
I saw the network leap. So I basically said to him, "Are you sure you haven't done anything?" "Oh yeah, we just plugged this one cable into the wall. We're just doing a bit of an office move actually this afternoon." Okay. Okay then, all right. So reverse whatever you've done. So, all I've done in the server room is put one cable into the switch. Well, so I unplugged that. No, nothing happened. Well, luckily I was going into the city to replace this hard drive what had failed. And I sort of just drop in and into the site to see what had happened, to actually see what had gone wrong. But she didn't tell us that she was moving PCs around or anything. I said, "Show me where your server room is." And there it was, the switch, like a fairy Christmas tree, lights blinking like there's no tomorrow. And I go, someone's plugged something in. Tell me what's happened this afternoon. And goes, we've been moving this office around. And I go, okay then. And I looked at it, there's four switches, like a massive man of cables in this server room. And I thought, oh no, I'm not going to have to go unplug all those cables and then plug one back in. I said, look, what PC did you unplug? So she showed me this little room with like 8 PCs in it. And I go, she goes, oh, we've been moving these PCs. I went around and unplugged every single PC in this 8 PC. Surprisingly enough, when I unplugged them all, the network came back to life and everyone could work again. So I slowly started tracing where all these cables going, and what they had is they had the IP phone. So you, on the IP phones, you kind of get like, so you can data chain them. So like you have the wall socket, then it goes into your phone, and then the phone network cable goes into the wall.
Yeah, and we used to have that my old workplace.
So what had happened was is that someone had, she'd looped the phone. So she, for the connection from the network, socket on the wall to the phone, and then the phone socket, so there's two connections, so the wall to the phone, and then on the other socket, when it go from that socket to the computer, was going into the wall socket. So it had created a loop. So cause those little phones have like little Cisco, little IP, little switches in them. So, and that what was called the loop.
So there was no. Isn't that not fixed? But you can get around that with spanning tree, can you?
Spanning tree is kind of does that, but there's no one to set the switches up to it. So spanning tree kind of like stops creating loops when you configure switches. So you can do it. So like if you've got like three switches, like a triangle. If you think about it, I think we must have done a podcast about it before. That,
so yeah, we did a podcast where we all drew triangles.
Yeah, so you've got triangles, you've got the switch at the top and the switch at the bottom and the switch on the right-hand side, you've got a triangle. So obviously if you had that in a loop, you didn't even get that triangle. So if that wouldn't work because there's a loop, and obviously spanning tree would block one of those ports, so one of the ports between the switches. And then if a switch died or a cable died, it would bring the other port up between the switches. Whereas there's another thing as well where you can do loop protection. So every couple of seconds, each port will send out a little packet. And if it sends out a packet and then it receives that packet on another port on that same switch, it obviously knows it's a loop. So it shuts those two ports down. So if we had that, that would have solved their problem today.
So is that something on the switch, that loop protection?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's on normally on like a layer 2, layer 3 switch, like a managed proper switch. Well, it's quite cool. So loop protection. So it's all different names or different things. So that's my first thing of the day for the that. So.
Yeah, always fun crawling under people's desks trying to work out where networks, what's going on with the network, isn't it?
But as soon as I saw that light flashing. Like, I was like, no, there's definitely a loop in the network. What have you done? Kind of thing. So, what has everyone else been doing then today? Anyone had any bad as me on the Friday the 13th? Kind of thing. So,
no. Unfortunately for the podcast, no. But fortunately for me, no. So that was good. Touch wood, we haven't had any gremlins with the recording yet, which is good as well. So. Wait for everything to crash after I said that.
So what have you been up to then, Andy?
Well, I've replaced a motherboard this week in a gaming machine. He basically diagnosed it was something wrong with the motherboard. And he went ahead and got this... It was basically like a gaming kit motherboard set. I don't know exactly where he got it from. I think it was something like Maplin or somewhere like that he bought it from. So it was basically, you got the motherboard, you got an i7, they give you 8 gigs of RAM, and I think that was it. That's what they give you. So he basically said to me, or called me up and said, right, I've got this new motherboard, can you come round and fit it all? So, okay. So when we went round, I had a look at it. I said, okay, this looks good. But what you have to realise as well is a couple of weeks beforehand, he just bought some brand new... he just bought 16 gig of memory, which was for his old motherboard. But what he failed to realise is that his old motherboard was DDR3. And the motherboard he just bought was DDR4. Thus rendering his brand new memory useless in the new motherboard.
Is it not backwards compatible?
Yeah. No, it doesn't physically fit the slot. Yeah, so it doesn't physically go in. If it was just a different speed or whatever... megahertz speed, then it probably would be backwards compatible, but it has another little keyway slot for it to go in. It's in a different place. So, I mean, that was a bit of a waste considering he just bought it. But otherwise, yeah, we just had to take it all out. Oh, it was a big pain as well because he's got one of these, one of these huge gaming fans, well, huge Kulim fans you can get, air-cooled with a big massive heatsink on it. He had one of them on his old motherboard. Luckily, we managed to make it fit on the new motherboard. I think he did have it. Yeah, he had a 10. I can't remember the chipset of the old one, but the chip shape, say, where the fans go in, the holes around the processor, if you like, they're different for different chipsets, aren't they? AMDs are different to i7s and stuff. Luckily,
different sockets. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, luckily, he had the in the box which he had for this cooling fan, which is also quite new. He had all the different adapters to fit different chipsets and different sockets in there. So it was a bit of a pain, especially when you've got a big, massive fan to install. It's always a bit more of a pain than usual, because when you took this motherboard out of the box, it had a standard fan on it. I had the memory plugged into it. It was basically ready to go. But we had to take the fan off, get the other fan out, you know, unbolt it from the old motherboard, bolt it onto the new one. It's basically like an air cooled with two fans on it, massive heat sink on it. Previous to that, I actually had a water cooled one or liquid cooled one, which had a little pump on it and a radiator in there. I don't know which one works better, liquid filled or air cooled. I think there's a lot of debate about that, isn't there, about which one's better than the other. I don't know myself, but rebuilt that. And then we just thought, it didn't have anything important on it at the time, so we just thought, right, tell you what we'll do. We'll just take the risk and plug the hard drive in to the new motherboard and see if it boots or not. So we went to do that, plugged it all in, switched it on, told it to boot from the SSD drive. And I got about 2 seconds into booting up and it blue screened. So we tried it a few times, just blue screened every time. So we just took the decision then to reinstall it all from scratch. So then we started the reinstall, did all that, and all worked out pretty well in the end. Bit of a long-winded job, you know, having to do the fan and everything and bolt the motherboard back in the back in the case again. But it worked out all right in the end. And works fine. The only unfortunate thing is the 16 gig of memory he had previously and now doesn't have any more. So I think he's actually going to sell that 16 gig and buy some new DDR4, get another 8 gig of that or something like that. So that's one thing that I've done this week. And then another one, again, was to do with the fan, funnily enough. This is down the other end of the world, down the bottom end. And it was... I actually remember he phoned me up about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And he'd said that it looked like the power supply had failed. And because it won't switch on at all. And can I get him another power supply? And then, you know, and if I get my new power supply, come down and fit it. So he had, yeah, no problem. It was one of these, slimline power supplies that goes in these slim cases. So it's not your regular size power supply. So I think it was only the next day or something. And he phoned me up and he said, my nephew's got one and he's got one on order. It's coming through, you know, in a couple of days. I said, all right, okay, no problem. So a couple of days later, he phoned me back and said, I've got that power supply. he said, it's okay though, you don't have to come down, because he said, my nephew can do it. I thought, oh, right, okay. I thought that was a bit cheeky in the whole scheme of things, asking me to get it, asking me to come down and fit it, and then his nephew would do it. So I said, okay, well, no problem. And actually, when he went off the phone, I thought, I bet something goes wrong. You know, and in one kind of mean way, I suppose, I thought, I hope something goes wrong. And lo and behold, a couple of weeks after, he phones me up and he said, I don't know what's up with the computer. He said, it keeps going off. So I said, what do you mean by it keeps going off? Because that could mean 100 different things, couldn't it? He said, you know, the whole thing goes dead. He said, it starts to load up and then the whole thing goes dead. So he said, better come down and have a look at it. So headed down there, took the side off, just wondering whether this power supply that they'd bought was a new one or a cheap one or wasn't the right one or whatever. And that's when I was checking all the connections and everything. And that's when I noticed that the heatsink on his fan was loose. So what this, I think he's a kid anyway, what this kid had done, he'd put the new power supply in and basically probably accidentally lifted the latch on the processor. So it wasn't sort of clamped in tight anymore, or he must have loosened it in some way. And then a couple of weeks later, it just popped out. So basically, the machine was running with no heatsink touching the top of it because it was loose. So
the processor itself was loose, or just the heatsink?
Just the heatsink.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but that's what was happening. It booted up, and a couple of minutes later, of course, the processor would get red hot, wasn't it? And then it was shutting down. So at my trusty tool bag that we were talking about a couple of weeks ago, and there's actually one extra thing in it that I forgot to mention at the time, in my tool bag anyway, was some heatsink compound. So I used a bit of new heatsink compound to put this heatsink back on again, and then booted it, and then I think we left it for about 10 minutes or so, something like that, and it was running fine. It's run fine ever since. So there were two run-ins with fans.
Just for the benefit of any new listeners, that was episode 36.
Okay.
where we describe what we took with us on site.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, it was a good episode, that, wasn't it? There's a lot of interesting different ideas and different methods and tools and stuff like that. But there's one extra, you know, heatsink compound. That's another one to put in your bag. Yeah. If you're coming across stuff like that, of course.
You've never used it before, it's the messiest stuff in the universe as well. If you don't know what you're doing, you can get it everywhere.
You mean put it over the whole chip, or just in the middle of the chip, or is it any?
I think different people swear by different methods, don't they? And,
There are different ways. I mean, by the time you clamp it in, it just squashes the entire width of it anyway, so it really doesn't matter. But you've
got to be careful it doesn't drip over the sides then.
Yeah, so I think it's more concentrated in the middle, if anything. You know, I suppose a blob in the middle will do it. Or if you sort of like draw a W shape on it or something like that, and then squash it down, it's going to cover the whole lot, isn't it? So,
But you're right.
You don't need much of it. But if you're cleaning the old stuff off, it is messy. If you get it on your hands, you know, it's there all day.
And whatever you touch.
Regular soap doesn't budge it, you know. It's like getting
episode 30 was the spanning tree show titled Flashing Like a Christmas Tree.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I remember that one.
that you can go back and listen and learn about spanning tree. So, so what have you been up to then, Jerry?
I have been up to a few things. I've learned a bit of Python. I saw you put that in the show notes there.
Because I was listening to it. I'm going to put that in it to you. Don't forget.
Yeah, I did say that I would, didn't I? But I've learned a bit, but it's all very basic stuff. Like I've been following the automate the boring stuff with Python. It's called, I'll put a link in the show notes.
Is that a podcast then? Or?
No, it's a book, and it's one of those books that's all online as well.
Okay.
So, yeah, I've been following that. I just learned to do some really basic stuff like functions, which is basically groups of commands and things that you can, yeah, you can write a little kind of sub-program, which you can then put parameters into.
Yeah.
Obviously done the Hello World stuff.
Yeah.
And the kind of differences between strings, integers, and there's another thing that shows you how far I've got. I'm not very far, but I would recommend that automate the boring stuff because it does quite a good job of walking.
Is it
through.
Online? Is it free online? I have to pay for it.
Yeah, it's free. Yeah, and it's got the like really basic how you know. Python 101 kind of stuff, and then it's got some examples of things to write. I've got an idea for my first project though. It's going to be my an invoicing system because currently I number my invoices in binary, so I've always got to find out what the next number is. I've got to store the number somewhere. The thing with Python seems to be that there's these modules that people have written to interface with different things. So there's one that interfaces with AWS. It's called Boto, B-O-T-O. And there's one that interfaces with Google Docs. So currently I do my invoices in Google Docs and then email them to clients as PDFs. So I was thinking I might, just as a little project to kind of get comfortable with it, do that really and plus it will help me out when it comes to invoicing clients. So
I didn't know you could do that. I didn't know you could download your stuff from Google Drive into PDFs. Interesting.
Or you can email this attachment, which is what I do.
All right.
But another thing I've heard about is you can turn an HTML file into PDF.
Okay.
There's a little Linux utility that will do that. So. That might be another way to go, but getting my invoicing system up and running. So what I envision is like name of the client and the amount or the line item, and then it kind of asks you those questions and then it prints out a nice invoice for you or sends it off to the client. But watch this space.
I think you should write a tic-tac-toe program, noughts and crosses.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That's quite
one
easy.
That plays itself like in war games.
You can get you can get Python on Nightingale. You can download it from there.
So get it Windows and so on. But it's a useful little language, I think. It's as good a place to start as any with that kind of more advanced programming languages, I think. So,
where does it allow you to lead to? You know, I mean, it does some basic stuff, but what can you ultimately do with it?
Well, like at work, I think I mentioned in the last podcast that a lot of the scripts that do various bits and bobs are written in Python, so it allowed me to do my job a bit better, and it you can do stuff with sysadmin kind of side of things, but you can do a bit more kind of stuff, a bit more advanced than Bash in terms of what you can do with the programming side of it. You can do things more easily in Python than you can in Bash, which is the kind of go-to scripting language in Linux, I'd say.
Yeah, scripting's good. I mean, I learned quite a bit doing so much. Like, I had today, they wanted. So I think I might talk about the last show where, like, it's a script where it emails you every day. If, like, after 10 days, it emails. If when your password expires, it emails. When your password expires after a certain day, if it expires in 10 days, it will email you every day to tell you the password expired and then until you're part and that kind of thing. But my boss wanted me to put it onto one of our clients, but he only wanted to email you on the 10th day and the day before. But the script I got off the internet didn't do that, so I had to hack the script to do it. So I managed to do it, but I had to do it in two separate scripts. I probably could have worked out if I had time, but I only had 2 hours to do it. So, like, well, one script basically did 10, and the other script did one. I just had to change a variable, and I just basically run the different scripts at different times. I'm guessing it's probably I could have done something clever. But I wanted it so that on the 10th day, it said, oh, your password expires in 10 days. But I wanted the one what was expired in one day, say, tomorrow your password will expire kind of thing. So.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, you'll get there. The thing with scripts is you can always go back and refactor them.
Yeah.
So...
But yeah, now, it's really good. I like scripting. It's good.
You
could do a 12 days of Christmas with that script, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
The 12 days of scripting my Python gave to me.
So I had fun as well there. So you were talking about ButterFS the other day. I got it working production, actually.
Oh, really? That's brave of you, according to its reputation, anyway.
Yeah.
I've never had any problems with it.
We had a customer who had a DR test the other week, and they were using Veeam backup replication, and we replicating their machines off from one host to another host halfway across. They basically got a big site, and there's like a gig fiber link between, so every 2 hours it basically just changes. So we basically did a test, and we basically just disconnected the server from the network, created a little network, put a PC on it, and then booted the service up, and yeah, it all worked fine. We were checking all the data we could access, but the only data they couldn't access was this marketing data, and the marketing data was stored on the NAS because they didn't want to spend the money to put an extra disk in the server to do it. It has like a little ready NAS. But that wasn't replicating off-site, so we sold them some two Shodology boxes, and then we replicate the data between the two. And when you set it up, it asked you if you wanted to format the disks in EXT4 or ButterFS.
Oh, right, okay.
And if you do it in EXT4, you can only do like a backup of it from one machine to the other, but with like ButterFS, you can do snapshots of the thing, so... Every 2 hours, it does a snapshot of the data. So if they ever got CryptoLocker, we could roll it back. And then every 2 hours, that replicates a snapshot to the other server, to the other NAS kind of thing. So,
yeah, I mean, that's the power of it. I mean, I think storage people would kind of scoff at ButterFS and say, oh, ZFS is much better than that.
Yeah. But it works.
It does,
It's a nice little Synology DS7116. So I'll put the link in the show notes. So it took a bit of time. I had like 80 gigs worth of data to transfer onto it. It took ages to get it onto it from this old NAS. But when it does the replication between the two, blindingly fast, it's like maxing out the... good about Synology is if you go into it, you can like it does like a sync change of the CPU and the network, and you can see that it was using 100% of the network kind of thing. So it was good. So yeah, so that was interesting.
Good to see it. Well, it's actually a NAS, like the default firmware that comes with the NAS lets you use ButterFS. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's cool. Nice.
So have you been doing Ansible a lot anymore, or
just kind of for my own stuff. I've been building up my server a bit. I think I mentioned that in the last podcast, using containers on my server. So I think most recently I've built a MySQL container, which I'm going to use for various bits and bobs, but yeah, getting that built up in Ansible most recently. Speaking of Ansible, actually, I mentioned I went to Ansible Fest, a kind of conference.
Was there any beer there? It sounds like you said beer there.
Yeah, there was quite a lot of beer. Free beer, after all the talks. But there was a link to a talk about Ansible on Windows. This guy has worked quite a bit on how to provision and configure Windows servers using Ansible. So I've put a link in the show notes for that. I can't particularly remember any of the points he made because it's Windows and I don't really use Windows Server. So, I remember it was quite interesting. So there's a link to the video in the show notes. It's about half an hour long. So it's worth a watch, definitely. What else have I been up to?
What about Terraform? You've been using it in anger, kind of thing.
I've got to the stage where I've had to build some new infrastructure rather than just configuring or reconfiguring the infrastructure that I sort of inherited when I started the job. And this is for this a streaming service that I work for, and they want to support Sonos speakers. I don't know if you come across those.
Yeah.
So this is the infrastructure to support that. The guy's been working on, the developer's been working on coding all the back end up. And so now it's up to me to actually build the infrastructure to run that on. So really it's kind of a copy and pasting exercise, but in doing that, I'm kind of going through all the Terraform stuff that was written by the company before I got there, understanding how that all works, and yeah, copying and pasting the right bits to the right places to make the all the AWS stuff come up where how it should. So yeah, that's all been interesting. Not quite there yet, but I think I've just got a database to build, database to provision and so on, and then that'll be done. On the freelance side, sort of one of my very first clients got back in touch with me about Isinga 2, which is quite different to Isinga 1, which is basically a reskinned Nagios with maybe a bit of a different database. And so I'm going to be replacing the current kind of Nagios based infrastructure there with Isinga 2. A nice thing about this is someone else has kind of done a bit of the hard work for me. They got in touch with this other company while I was starting to work at my new day job, and they've this company have kindly built a proof of concept. So I actually worked with Isinga 2 before for another client, but I never finished it because I just got a bit bogged down in the configuration. So yeah, this company have built this proof of concept, and I'm going to be rolling this out to where all the Nagios stuff is at the mm-hmm. moment. So that should be fun. And yeah, last but not least, a client actually came to me, an existing client. They found a bit of software called R-Clone. I will put a link in the show notes to that as well. But it's basically, it's a bit of software written in Go, programming language, which quite a lot of stuff is written in these days. People seem to like it. And it's like rsync, but it can talk to sort of cloud storage services like Amazon S3, Dropbox, which is what I'm working with, and various other kind of storage services, and it will just treat the those as like a kind of a network drive, if you like. So at this point I'm working with Dropbox to do a remote backup of his server, And he wants it to run like our snapshot, which I've mentioned in the past. So to have like seven daily backups, and then the seventh daily backup turns into the weekly backup, and then you get four weekly backups. Yeah. And then the weekly backup turns into the fourth weekly backup turns into monthly backup, get 12 monthly backups. So apparently there's unlimited space with Dropbox for business, which is what he's using. And so my task is to write a script that will do that, incremental backup stuff.
It's a programming language.
It's quite a low level programming language, done by Google. And yes, it seems pretty good. So like some of the utilities, my day job, that I inherited are written in Go. So it's kind of lower level than something like Python or whatever. It's compiled, but it always compiles to a single binary, so you never have any dependencies or anything with binary. So yes, it's good. Seems good. Okay. Maybe after I've done a bit of Python, I can try my hand at Go, but it might be a while.
So talking about monitoring, I've been using an NTOP NG server this week. We've got one of our customers has got a problem where they've only got like a 4 meg internet connection up and down, because they're in like a service building, and they basically just RDPing to a remote server. But it keeps freezing and keeps locking up, and I've basically got like monitoring on it, like using the SNMP from the Virgil. But that doesn't really show. It shows you like the bandwidth you use, but it doesn't show you. So it only does like. It basically just pulls data every couple of minutes or whatever, but obviously it shows you that like average, doesn't it?
Well, it shows you how much data is being used, but not not what ports are you using.
Say if someone you've got a 4 meg thing, and like in a minute you could download 4 meg, but like for a couple of seconds it could be maxing out the bandwidth, and that's when people are getting disconnected from the session, kind of thing. So like with the Virgils, you do get quite a good thing where you can actually look at the sessions and see who's got out and then what connections, but it's not nice. So I got Cacti monitoring my SNMP on all the routers so I can see what sort of bandwidth, kind of thing. So yes, I've got an old PC built with a Linux with Ubuntu on it. And so I'm going to basically put a monitoring port on the output of, say, where the router's plugged in. I'm going to put a monitoring port, which basically means that anything on this port goes out to the internet, gets monitored to another port. So what happens is this box basically filters, gets all the traffic, and then it will show you what's happening on the thing. So it basically show you who all the top talkers are and stuff, and we should be able to see in real time who's using the traffic and if there's any offenders kind of thing.
Do that by IP? Or?
Yes. You can see what the sessions are and how much. Basically, so it records. If it sees someone downloading 4 meg files or downloading the internet or something, you'll see it, and it basically gives you a list of what ports they're connected to. Hmm. So NTOP was, I think, developed by someone, and if you just type in app get installed in NTOP, it gives you like one from like 2004, so it's quite a basic one. It's not very nice. But I think there's some people who bought the source code for NTOP called NTOP NG. So there's a community version still, which is the NTOP NGD. And you have to do a bit of like importing. You basically put where the packages are located, and you can type in. When you're in Ubuntu or whatever, you can basically you put it into your source list, don't you? And you can basically.
Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah.
So you basically just like top in and install ng, and it'll basically then download it. And it's lovely. It's like got a nice little graphical interface.
It runs its own web server, doesn't it? I think I remember installing it in my old job.
Yeah, basically it opens up on port 3000 or something. So
yeah, it's got its own GUI. Yeah, and it's quite nice. I was expecting like a command line utility or something, but. Top in Linux.
Yeah, so I think it's called Network Top. I think probably you could run it, but it's like a little graphical. Well, then we can kind of see definitely what's happening at this site. So also, because I'm doing quite a bit on support at the moment, I had an issue where we had a customer phone up on a terminal server who's got this really old application they're using. it's like they mill, they produce animal feed, and they got like this program for the 1990s. It's horrible. It's like a DOS program. When it tries and prints, it basically prints it to a file, then it brings it up in a notepad, and then you can print it out. But this person couldn't actually, when he pressed print, it basically came up by saying this file's already in use. Or it didn't actually say that, so they couldn't create a file. So luckily, there's still a company out there that supports the software. And I phoned them up and said, oh yeah, looks like we can need to find out who's got this file open. And I couldn't work out, it's basically a network share. So like in Windows, I don't know if you know, so you can do in the old 2003, there's like a snap-in called file sharing or storage sharing or something.
I do remember that because actually Windows 2000 server I was using it with, because there was lots of people trying to access the same file.
Yeah.
And it was just a computer management MMC bit.
Yeah, and you can do it again in 2012, but it's not on by default. You just go, oh, I'm a senior pick. And that basically showed you who's got the files open, but it didn't show you that list on there very well. So I didn't show you the file I wanted to be open. So it's actually a command line version of that called open files. And you do open files forward slash query, like a minus V. And that basically shows what's in, like what that actual MMC brings up. So you can see who's got it up, which is quite nice. But that didn't share it either, but it was still not doing so. There's a load of applications called SysInternals, which is like some really good, cool tools which people have written, and then someone from Microsoft brought SysInternals, so they now work for Microsoft. And they do a nice utility called Process Explorer, so if you ever have a problem with like memory being usage on your machine, and you can like basically look at it and work out what applications and what, so if you've got like a service running, it will show you what all the underlying applications are running. So it's really cool. So they've also produced a file, wasn't they, called handle.exe, and that basically you type that handle.exe and then you put the path of where your file's open, and it basically tells you what handle has that file open. So I'm guessing it must be like a CPU handle, I'm guessing. I'll put a link in the show notes to that. And that basically, I never seen this comment, and it shows you what the handle is. And then from there, you can basically use the handle command to kill that, what that process was got it open. So
what is a handle?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I'm guessing it's something like a CPU, I'm guessing, like a process. Okay. Like, it's a process ID, like a PID, if you ever had that, like where you, I think you get the same thing in Linux, don't you? Where it's like an application. Yeah. So you can type a command, like, and it will tell you what that PID is. And then you can use a command in Windows called taskkill, and that will kill the application kind of thing. So I think a handle is something happening inside the PID. So the process ID, so if you don't want to cancel the whole process ID, you can kill the handle, if you know what I mean. So
yeah.
Maybe I'll have a look at that later in the next week before the show. So
Just in case anyone is interested, in the equivalent in Linux is LSOF, like it's list open files basically. Mm-hmm. So if you type that, then you'll get a whole load of files that are open. I can't remember all the switches. There was a point where I used it quite a lot, but I haven't used it for a while. So maybe we can talk about that in another show when I'm a bit more prepared.
So the other thing I wanted to talk about is like this remote management, RMM stands for remote manage and monitor. So it's like an MSP thing. So we have this little agent installed on all of our servers and computers we look after, and it basically monitors anything you want it to monitor, basically. So one bit it does this thing is that it monitors, you can remote people's machines. So if someone phones up and say, help, I need my PC, you can say, we can jump on the machine kind of thing. It's like a little VNC, basically like a VNC splash top onto their remote machine. So everyone has like a little agent in the computer. It's like the old VNC day where you have to right click and say, what's your IP address or what's your name of your name, so you can connect to it. kind of thing. But with RME, it's quite good. The application we've got is that you can kind of search for that computer name, but also you can kind of like it's listed like within different companies. We've got different companies in different groups, so you can go into that group, and if you know that person, that group is Mike you're talking to, it shows you who the current user is. So you can say, oh yeah, Mike's on that PC, I can click on the machine and then I can connect to his machine without even asking him who he is or what machine his name is. So that's quite cool. And the other thing you can do is kind of like it's that's the managing of it. So you can manage it, you can remote onto them, help them, file transfer, kill processes. And you can also do quite a good thing is that you can bring a command prompt up from that machine. So you can run commands without them knowing. So you can don't have to, you can connect into it, and you can do really cool stuff. So you basically got a command prompt into their machine, but they don't know you connect. They don't have to know you're connected. And
have these machines got CD-ROM drives?
Well, so we could eject it.
Kind of yeah.
So the cool thing is that, like, I've never known that you can do so much with a netuse command. Or the net command. I mean, I never used it for like net use and connecting disjoining network drives and stuff. But there's so much more you can do with it. Like, some of our clients, their admin password keeps getting locked out, but we never get around to doing it. So looking at why it's locking out. But you can remotely unlock so like if you try not, so if you RDP onto a server or via this product, it says like your account's locked out, but you can use the going into command prompt. You can then use net use, and you can then use type net use and then the user account of what it is, and then /domain if it's on domain control as we are, and you go /active, :, and then it says yes, and then you click return. It sends that command and it unlocks the user account for you. It's just so helpful. And then if you wanted to, you can then add users by just doing net use as well. Then you can add users as well. So add another where they wanted to work out. A woman wanted, we took over a new customer and they wanted to take admin rights off these three PCs. So they happened to like dialing into the PC, going through the graphical interface. If you type in net space local group space administrators, click return, it lists all the users in the administrator group, and then you can run another command, net local group administrator, and then the actual username of the user you want to delete from the admin group. So mine was like the domain / the username and then / delete. It deletes the user it removes that user from the administrator. So the next time they log on, they won't have admin rights. So you can do this all without having to connect to the machine or any, or not having to RDP onto the machine or getting saying, can I use your machine kind of thing, or writing any group policy to do it. You can do it all from it. And the brilliant thing as well with this is that you can write scripts. And they're called, I can't think what they're called now, but then once you've written a script, you can then deploy that to all your agents. So like we have a local user we add onto all our machines we manage, which is a like a local admin user. So if anything ever happens, we've got a way of getting onto that server. And someone's written a script which basically does that using the net log, the net command, and you say, I want to deploy this script to these 10 PCs or whatever. I'm guessing, I mean, it's a bit like Ansible, I'm guessing, kind of thing. Or
Well, it sounds more like running shell scripts. It's making me think of when I first started at my previous employer, and they were all Linux workstations that they were using. So, which is fairly unusual. We had all these kind of tricks and things to get things working on users' local machine. Didn't have anything like the sort of centralized management that you have with Windows, but. You have to kind of build that yourself. It's what it reminds me of, definitely. If we'd had Ansible in those days, it would have made life a lot easier.
It just makes my life so much easier. Just, I need to deploy something. I need to deploy the Flash update. Right, download the package, package it up, and deploy it to all these machines. And it can report back saying if it has or not. Another command I'll put in the show notes as well is like it. we get alerts. So you can also set up alerts for, like, if the disk size gets low on space on servers or whatever, and PCs, and, like, CPU and RAM. And this product actually integrates in with our help desk system, so it actually generates tickets when it does this. So if we get, we're on the server, we do it for PCs, along as servers. If there's a server, we can jump on and do, have a look. But as a PC, we can kind of, like, have a look before we get onto it. So one of the guys wrote a little bit of little, well, I don't know if you found it or we found it on the internet, but like a little thing that's basically, it's called four files. So I'm guessing it must look at every single file, and it basically finds any size file which is over 200 meg. So it will basically just list, and then you can look at if you want to, if what files can be deleted, kind of thing. So I mean, you really need to look at, with an MSP, you kind of have to be a step in advance. So you don't go, like with today, for some reason I need to work out why we didn't get alerted for this disk drive filling up on this server. Why didn't our server alert didn't work on that monitor, kind of thing. So, because I've only deployed it, this application would go to about 25% of our customers, and they aren't, I don't think they're actually on our, to the end of the list yet. So, but you can also do things like if something gets lent in the event viewer. So, like, could we run all the HP servers? If you've got the HP tools installed, it will basically write to the if an event, like if a disk failed, it'll write that to the event viewer. And then I've basically found out what all these events are, and then if that get events, it then creates a ticket, kind of thing. Because I also found out today, like, as well, like, I found someone else, they always be monitoring meetings. It's basically, we found corrupt files or corrupt NTFS stuff on the corrupt NTFS partitions. So the file system said the NTFS file, and you need to run check disk. So we wouldn't have known about that until, so we can do preventative work rather than them phoning up and saying, oh, I can't access these files. But now it reports back saying, oh, we found it. And it was being alerted into event bit, but who goes into event look and until you need to look at it, if you know what I mean? So that's why it's quite,
it's always good to be ahead of the game, isn't it? Especially, like you're saying, you've got all these different companies to look after, I guess.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I am, that's one of the things I'm doing, is setting up something to look at logs, or to aggregate all the logs from all my clients' machines.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think I really need it for my current set of clients, but it'd be good to know how to do it. If I need to do it in future in a day job or whatever. So,
I always like alerting and monitoring and stuff, because, like, it's just so good. Because if you're monitoring the bandwidth on their site, and you know, like, it's noticed, it's like they're only using 5%, but then one day they're using 50%, and they're going, oh, we're at the internet. So as soon as you can look at that screen and say, oh, yeah, I can see that thing, or your CPU's, because it basically obviously monitors it and it graphs it all, so that you can say, oh, hang on a minute, why are we getting hyper CPUs between 12 and 2 and kind of thing? So you can kind of, it's just such a useful tool to have.
Having it all graphically presented as well is really handy. I remember we had a network problem in my old place, and you could see it on the graphs, you know, on the packets in and packets out graphs of our metric collection system, Ganglia. And it was made it a lot clearer where the problem was coming from, and where, you know, where to look and so on. Whereas if we didn't have that, we'd be sort of floundering around, not knowing where to look, kind of thing. So, yeah, cool. Very useful.
Yeah, and I'll put a link in the show notes. PRTG is a really good tool as well. It's a Windows tool. It's free for like 100. You can pay it, but I think you get 300 license. You get 100 300 licenses, and it's really good if you're not wanting to get involved in minutesing it. It does things like SNMP monitoring, disk space monitoring. It's really good to, like, I've been using to troubleshoot this issue, this site with a networking issue. So, yeah, it's good. Right, I think I've hadn't. I think I've written. I've spoke about everything I wanted to speak about tonight for a change. So
all admin'd out.
Yeah, I'm definitely having that today. I had enough of computers this week. Yeah. I've had enough. So
yeah.
Apparently, just a quick tip as well. Apparently, I was had an email come in. Apparently, if you've got a Weigel and it's got a DHCP server and you need to disable it because you've got like an onboard Windows SBS one, apparently the newest version of Weigels have two DHCP servers, one for IP4 and one for IP6, and you have to remember to disable them both the places. Otherwise, what the other DHCP server gets very moany.
I can imagine. So I guess clients are broadcasting on IPv6.
Yes, as well. I think yes. So they disabled it on IP4, but apparently you have to disable IP6 as well because it called basically shut. I think it basically with DHCP servers, you have to in Windows you activate them. So like if it sees another server, it would try and disactivate it. I think it was fighting against. So I think the IP4 one was working. I think then the IP6 one was then trying to disable it. So, yeah, two places to look on the good old Weigels.
I haven't done much with IPv6, but I think DHCP is a lot more important because you can't manually type in an IPv6 address.
You'd be there a long time.
So you've got to kind of provision all that in advance.
I was thinking about doing an IP6 talk for OddCamp, but I don't know what's happened with OddCamp. Is it happening? I know there's like a post saying, does anyone have kind of like...
I think Linux Luddites was the last place I heard it talked about, and they said it doesn't look like it's happening. But there's this FussTalk Live thing, isn't there? So
yeah,
that was, I think, the kind of this year's stand-in. Hopefully it'll come back. I mean, I'd run it, or I'd try to anyway.
Even if we just run kind of like just having a meetup, really, just get everyone to meet up and have a couple of talks kind of thing. That's all you need to do, isn't it?
Well, I think that's basically what FussTalk Live is going to be, isn't it? But it's only one evening. It's not a kind of weekend kind of thing.
Are you going to that? Or?
I'm going to go. Yeah, got me ticket. Apparently it's all sold out, but are you going?
Well... it all depends on certain things, but I haven't booked my ticket. So.
Oh, okay. Well, it's, they said, you know, it's in a pub and there's just like a function room.
Yeah.
Where the sort of podcasts are going to be. Yeah. So you can always go to the pub. Yeah. There'll probably be loads of people there anyway.
Okay, we'll make a weekend and we'll see what happens. I'll tell you more about that another time. But yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but did you hear about my... I was about to pull my AWS course, wasn't I? I meant to go on my AWS course, but I turned up and they cancelled it without telling me. Thank you for that.
That's nice.
Yeah. So I booked a hotel for 3 days or 4 nights and had train tickets booked. And my train tickets booked, so you can only use it on certain days, so I was like stranded in London. But luckily I just bought another ticket and apparently they are going to refund. They're going to refund me, apparently. So.
Okay.
Damn you two little letters of a training company in the UK, biggest training company, didn't bother to tell us that my training course was cancelled.
Does that begin with a Q and end with an A?
Maybe.
Any chance? Don't want to libel anyone, though. Allegedly.
Yeah. All right, then. Well, anything else to say, guys? Andy? Anyone? Jerry?
No, I think that's...
No, nothing more for now.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Sleep is what I need. It's 11 o'clock.
We need to start these podcasts earlier, don't we?
Yeah, well, if I hadn't had to do some work and not... Yeah, it would have been a hell earlier kind of thing. But damn servers and snapshots. Yeah. But that's the story for another time. Okay, well, again, you can always email us mail at admin@admin.co.uk and...
And don't forget our social media outlets as well.
Yeah. So speak to you all soon, guys.
Yeah, see you next time. Bye now.
Now it's over.